a little less sympathy. Lillian J, the old black dog, a pirate box, a rocking horse, all gone to Jubilee.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fifth installment, the first installment for this semester of Swing Politics. My name is Mitch Saunders, or as some of you know me, Big Mitch. And I'm going to make sure that everything's set up so I can get started to talk for the next around 53 minutes about politics. So give me 1 second and I'll be right on the air. Thanks so much.
Don't deserve me.
All right, and I'm ready to get started, so I hope everyone's morning is going well. It is a bright and early 7:06 Eastern Standard Time, of course. Again, I am Big Mitch, Mitch Saunders, and today for Swing Politics, it's going to be a little bit of catching up, some stuff that's been going on in the political world that has sort of been known to those that are politically engaged a little bit, but maybe not the specifics, and you probably wouldn't hear about it if you're not, you know, always listening to politics. So, let's jump right into it. So, I'd like to start by discussing the New York State Senate rejecting, there was a judicial nominee by Kathy Hochul, who's the governor of New York. She was, took the position, I believe, in late 2021 after Governor Andrew Cuomo retired due to sexual assault allegations, from what I understand. And so Hochul took the office in, I believe, late 2021 or early 2022. And she has sort of been seen as, in the political world, a bit of a moderate. Her political career begins with, in 2011, she won a House race that she really wasn't supposed to win. It was a race in upstate New York in a competitive district, and she was supposed to lose. This was in 2011, so it was still, you know, prime red wave territory. It was, you know, shortly after the 2010 Republican, as President Obama called it, quote-unquote, shellacking of the Democratic Party in midterms. And she ended up winning that House race due to the fact that the Republican Party was split between the Republican Party on the ticket as well as the Conservative Party on the ticket having a candidate. As in New York, there are multiple parties that can have affiliation with various candidates. So the Working Families Party and the Conservative Party can both either put up their own candidate in New York, or they can have their sort of area on the ballot where they normally would put up a candidate and endorse the Democrat for the Working Families Party, or the Republican if the Conservative Party feels that's appropriate. So it was a Democrat who was endorsed by the Working Families Party, I believe, running against a Republican as well as a Conservative. So the Republican and the Conservative split the ticket, and Hochul, the Democrat, went running in 2011 for the House seat, ended up winning the seat by about 3%. She won it with, I believe, like 48% or 45%, not a majority, and she wasn't really supposed to win it in the first place. It was only because the Republicans had split even, you know, the slightest amount that gave her the opening to go to the House. In 2018, she was elected a lieutenant governor, realistically in the primary, because New York, as we know, is not a necessarily competitive state, though she would go on to make it a competitive state, believe it or not. But in 2018, she ended up winning the lieutenant governor primary by about 7 points. It was about 53.5% to 46.5%. And she was the lieutenant governor to Cuomo. Those two were elected independent of each other. So, after that, little did she know that lieutenant governor position would be so important. And in 2021, 2022, she took up the mantle of governorship after Cuomo retired. And she's been relatively good for the Democrats thus far. She's been sort of U.S. Supreme Court knocked down a New York law that had allowed for a lot of gun restrictions and you know, more gun safety laws. And Hochul very astutely, you know, worked with the state legislature and political advisors to sort of be able to skirt this, in that, you know, most public places there's still the same gun laws, but they have to be designated in a certain way that's able to get around the Supreme Court's ruling. You know, she's stated countless times that she's, you know, pro-abortion, and that she would, you know, sign in the right to an abortion and the like. However, she's recently taken a turn as a you know, these actions were largely before the 2022 elections, and she has taken quite a rightward turn in her political tenure for some reason at this time. And I think what this sort of can be tied to is the 2022 election, in which Republicans funneled money into especially the New York governor's race and also the down ballot races below it, notably the House elections. Now, of course, this midterm was not a red wave, as I predicted. It was a blue wave. It was not a blue wave. It was a blue sort of riptide in some places. Some places were neutral. And in New York, Florida, and California, however, there was more of a red wave that materialized, no more so in New York and Florida than anywhere else. And in New York, Republicans ended up holding seats they sort of were challenged to do, and they flipped seats they didn't know they would. Obviously, with George Santos, that whole Republican Party debacle, honestly, he ended up winning that seat in New York 3. But they flipped New York 4, both of which are New York 3 and New York 4 are both Biden plus 10 seats, Biden plus 15 seats. They also flipped New York 17 with Mike Lawler flipping Sean Patrick Maloney's seat, which in my opinion is not the worst thing because of what Sean Patrick Maloney did to Mondaire Jones, sort of carpetbagging. It was not likely that this would happen, but I can't say that I'm shocked. And then New York 19 as well, which is more upstate. And they also held the Syracuse-based seat, which was a Biden plus 8 seats. So they had a pretty good New York House Republicans in New York had a pretty good, very good showing. And this all sort of materialized at the top of the ticket, where Kathy Hochul only won by around 6 points. Against opponent Lee Zeldin, who is the former congressman, then congressman at the time, running from New York 1, which is sort of the edge of Long Island. So, I don't know, you know, what can you attribute her major, you know, sort of... I would consider a 6-point victory in New York to be a loss. I mean, Biden won the state by 25, 30 points. It's not a competitive state. You have, you know, all 5 boroughs, you have... Westchester, you have, you know, some parts of Long Island, I suppose, because a lot of Long Island is conservative, and a 6-point victory in New York is embarrassing. So where did Hochul go wrong? I mean, she didn't do very much campaigning, was a big thing. She sort of thought she had it in the bag, that Democrats would just come home for her and that Republicans liked her. But also, I think Zeldin ran a phenomenal campaign which focused on crime. And I think that the nuance behind that is that the crime message didn't work really anywhere else except for New York. And so what exactly can you attribute that to? I'd argue that in New York City itself, you have a mayor, Mayor Eric Adams, who is continually repeating the same notion over and over again that crime is high and that he's going to do something about it, and that then when realistically he, you know, hasn't made any major changes, and that, you know, crime is bad, you know, everyone before me has not been able to handle this and crime is really bad. And so when you have the mayor of the largest city in the entire nation saying that over and over again, it's going to start to resonate, especially with people that aren't as politically engaged. And Zeldin taking that message and sort of running on it, bringing those upstate numbers, which is sort of shocking because Hochul is also from Buffalo, so she's an upstate New York politician and historically has been. Zeldin was able to capitalize on that. The media markets were flooded with Republican funding. There was a lot of hope that Zeldin would be able to flip the seat. And I do think that there is a world in which Zeldin might have pulled off an insane upset and won that race. I think it would have been really hard to get those last 3% to cross over for him. But it was a super bad election for Democrats. And so, why is this important? From my standpoint, Hochul has taken a bit of a rightward turn relative to her stances prior to the election. And because of that, she has done one thing that sort of is unforgivable in my eyes, as well as the eyes of many Democrats, in that she has nominated someone for the highest court in the state, which I mentioned at the beginning of the hour. The highest court in the state, the New York Court of Appeals, which is equal to any state Supreme Court, and she's nominated effectively a conservative for that position, Hector LaSalle. There's been a lot of controversy over this nomination. LaSalle is rated the way that the nominating process for a state court of appeals judge goes is that there is a board that goes through a bunch of possible nominees, designates them as whether they are well qualified, and then sort of writes some notes about them. And this is submitted to the governor, and the governor decides from there. There was a opening on the Court of Appeals, and the reason why this nomination is so important is because three of those nominees are more liberal progressive side. Three of the sitting justices on the Court of Appeals are more liberal progressive and are more in favor of Democrats being, I wouldn't say activist, but sort of taking advantage of a state that they politically control. Whereas three are Cuomo-appointed moderate Democrats. I don't even know what exactly they are. Maybe conservadems. Much more right in the Democratic spectrum, and they feel that there's sort of a lot more precedent and, I guess, necessary tamping on political power that they don't want the Democrats to sort of overstep on, especially the state legislature, in that the New York state legislature has supermajorities in both the House and the state Senate, even after the Republicans did very well in the 2022 elections, which was the state legislature was effectively the only bright spot for New York Dems at the time in 2022 and, you know, going forward. And so the reason why LaSalle's nomination for this court was so controversial is because if there is a nominee that's more liberal or progressive that gets chosen to the court, then Democrats control the court. Liberal progressive Democrats will control the court to Cuomo appointees 4-3. And previously it was 4-3 for Cuomo appointees, and I'm sure everyone can remember the New York, if you follow politics, I'm sure most people might not remember. I'm a bit different than the normal news follower, but in New York, because I am a New Yorker, Democrats gerrymandered the congressional maps to make sure that they were very much in favor of Democrats likely gaining 22 seats, whereas Republicans would only probably win 4 seats. That wasn't necessarily set in stone. I believe the gerrymander would have broken given the 2022 popular vote in New York. However, when state legislature Democrats proposed that, it was brought up to the Court of Appeals by Republicans, and the Court of Appeals struck it down, and that forced and they forced an independent drawer who was a Republican to redraw the map. So if Democrats had, so if LaSalle got on the court, and we'll get to what happened in his nomination, if LaSalle got on the court, he would again reject plans for Democrats to redraw the congressional maps. And then the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has said that it is okay for political gerrymandering is completely constitutional, and that it's up to the state Supreme Courts. But mid-decade redistricting is not something out of the question for any state. So Democrats could try to redistrict to make sure that their party gains an edge. However, that only works if the Court of Appeals changes hands from Cuomo appointees to liberal progressive appointees. So LaSalle has a and LaSalle is Hochul's nominee, and LaSalle has a history of making anti-union, anti-abortion, anti-LGBTQ rulings. This is something that he has done not just once, but multiple times. And in his nomination, in his hearing, with the way that the hearing goes, is that the state Senate has to approve LaSalle by a supermajority in the simple majority in the state Senate. First, he has to go through a judiciary committee hearing, and after that, the Senate Judiciary Committee would vote to discharge his nomination to the full Senate if it got a simple majority in the committee. So, what happened was there was a 5-hour hearing plus additional information regarding his nomination, and additional information and discussion with him regarding his nomination, according to Andrea Stewart Cousins, who is the majority leader. And upon voting for the LaSalle nomination, it ended up failing 10-9, with 7 Republicans and 2 Democrats voting in favor of moving it towards the full body, and 10 Democrats voting no. So this killed the nomination for LaSalle. And the path forward, from what I've understood, is that Hochul is intending to sue, or has considered suing, for his nomination. However, suing for the nomination would just put his name back in contention in the state Senate, and the state Senate already rejected him, so the same result would happen again, unless something else were to happen with some, you know, bribery or political dealing, stuff and the like, but it seems unlikely that she is to succeed on that. So realistically, the reason why this is so important is because it might hold the key to Democrats retaking the U.S. House if redistricting were to happen and Hochul nominates someone more liberal, more progressive than Hector LaSalle, who is notably, in his rulings, as a conservative Democrat, regardless of what he said in the hearings. In the hearings, he said, no, I am pro-abortion, I am pro-union, when his words speak otherwise, and I don't think that you can really trust that, especially given that these positions are effectively lifetime. So, not entirely sure what Hochul's next steps are. I don't think that she is going to sue, according to a recent Politico article. I would say that it's very odd for someone to see a 6-point victory in New York, which is very small, and think about sort of their positions and sort of make more of a turn to the right. What she is interpreting in her mind is, oh, you know, I did win by that much. Maybe my policies aren't liked by that many people, and maybe I should try to pivot more towards the center and nominate someone. Maybe this is a good chance to nominate someone for the state Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, that is more moderate and more representative of more people in my state. This isn't the case. She's a bad candidate and ran a bad campaign, and I'm sure that you don't see Republicans in states, you know, in Midwest states that were to win elections by smaller margins than they previously did and think, oh, I have to win over more Democrats, so I'm going to put someone pro-choice on the state Supreme Court. Republicans don't do that. No matter what margin they win by, they will govern in a way that is extremely conservative, or even if they are moderately conservative, they will not try to pull over Democrats onto their side. They will not completely, you know, give in on their ideology to be more appealing to a group of people that didn't vote for them because it's not because they didn't agree with them. It's because they had someone else that really campaigned for their vote. And Zeldin wasn't afraid to go into New York City to find those votes. Hochul was, because she thought she had them in the bag, and ultimately she still won the election. That's sort of the only thing that matters. You know, it doesn't matter if you win by one vote or if you win by, you know, 100,000. If you win the race, you still get elected. But it doesn't really mean that she should pivot in that way, because New York is not a swing state, and she shouldn't govern like it is a swing state. So it's disappointing to see her do that and to put up someone with so many options, so many opportunities to enshrine so many great laws, and to have them be upheld by the Court of Appeals, and she chooses someone that is very much not in line with what Democrats support nationally and continue to support, even while going to bat for her. I mean, I voted for Hochul because she didn't give me any indication that I shouldn't vote for her. And now all of a sudden, you know, she's got a 4-year term and is delegating like she is, you know, an independent or, you know, a conservative Democrat. So personally, not super happy about that, but the New York State Senate is sort of the saving bastion for Democrats. My state senator voted no in that nomination. Even while she had COVID, she went into the building, voted no, and then left. Because she obviously didn't want to infect everyone. Her name was Shelley Mayer. And so, you know, I applaud the state Senate and the state House for keeping their stuff together, and making sure that someone like this wouldn't be allowed to have a lifetime seat on the Court of Appeals, and to get someone that will support the Democratic positions of, you know, having the right to choose and supporting unions, which are extremely weak at this time in history. And Hector LaSalle was not that person. So, I guess in catching up, that was sort of a big deal for the U.S. House and what that means for 2024. If Democrats are able to redistrict that state in their favor, they can gain, you know, a handful of at least 4 or 5 seats, which is right now the difference in the House, in that it's 212 to 213, which is a five-seat majority for the Republicans. And speaking of the House, there are a bunch of new rules that Kevin McCarthy, with his Republican caucus, has instituted. And I think some of them are hilarious because they hurt themselves. They shoot themselves in the foot. And it seems pretty commonplace for the Republicans. So some of these new rules for the House is no proxy voting, which, as I'm sure some can remember, Nancy Pelosi, when COVID hit, with her caucus, instituted proxy voting, where you didn't have to be in the House to vote. You could have another member who was in the House vote for you on behalf of, I know Mondaire Jones did that. Many people did that, where they would, where a fellow representative would go up and say on behalf of Jones, McBath, and, you know, list off a few names, and they say they vote yay or nay, depending on the vote. There is no more an office of congressional ethics, which is really funny considering George Santos is now in the Republican caucus. I guess there's no more investigations, ethics investigations that can go on for any member of Congress, which is I guess just a good way to keep the Republican, controversial Republicans out of the limelight, is to make sure that there is no office to investigate them. There is no more Gephardt rule. And what that means is that the House is normally, obviously everyone knows that there is, the U.S. has a debt, and there is a debt ceiling. And essentially what that means is that once the U.S. has spent a certain amount of money, the government is funded up to a certain point. And once the once that amount of money has been hit and the government is no longer funded until that time, as everything is planned out, so it will be funded to a specific date. And once that isn't there anymore, once that funding has lapsed, it's been spent, there's a Gephardt rule in the House that raising the debt ceiling, allowing the country to spend more and continue to have social services, continue to have the country effectively running. The Gephardt rule allowed for raising the debt ceiling automatically. Funding the government in specific ways requires a bill via reconciliation, which is a process that is employed by the House and the Senate to pass a bill that has to do specifically with the budget of the nation. But raising the debt ceiling would happen automatically. Members of Congress wouldn't have to take a vote on it, and they would it would just automatically sort of happen in the amount of the reconciliation bill that would pass. Now, there is no longer that rule. So Democrats and Republicans will now have to vote. Everyone in the House will have to vote on whether or not to raise the debt ceiling. I think it's hilarious because Republicans want to show themselves as fiscally conservative. That's like their whole thing, is that we need to be in control of the money that we're spending, and it's going rampant, and you know, Joe Biden is taking money out of your pocket, and, you know, blah 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 blah. When, funny enough, you know, they're saying Joe Biden's taking money out of your pocket, and when the Republicans just proposed a universal sales tax, I don't think that would go over so well with all those Republican voters that thought the House majority would then become so financially austere, and that, you know, spending wouldn't happen in that way. But now Republicans want to institute a universal sales tax. So that doesn't quite make a whole lot of sense. And the Gephardt rule actually allows Democrats to take political capital, in that when they are voting on raising the debt ceiling to not let the government default and for everyone to, you know, government jobs to be paid and for everything to just sort of keep functioning normally and for the U.S. to avoid a recession like we saw in 2008, Democrats will be able to vote, yes, I do want to keep the government funded, and they'll be able to see that. Whereas many of the Republicans will say, no, I don't want the government to be funded, I don't want the debt ceiling to be raised, when realistically, very, very few people care about whether or not the government's in debt. They care if they're doing well. And yes, the U.S. has a lot of debt, but every country has debt. And it's more important that people have a satisfied, healthy, comfortable way of life than the government being, you know, financially strict and making sure that funding isn't there, and making sure that, you know, certain programs aren't funded. I mean, Republicans want to cut Medicare and Social Security. That's something that's a big part of their platform, and it has been for decades now. And even Trump just came out against it. He just said, Republicans do not cut, you know, Social Security and Medicare, because he knows it's politically toxic. Even Trump knows that that is a stupid idea, yet you have the House Freedom Caucus, which is the most right-wing caucus in the Republican Party that has basically controlled McCarthy in these new rules, which I'll continue to get to. This House Freedom Caucus basically controls the what the Republicans can do, because there's, I think, like 14, 15 of them, and the vote majority is only 5. So they can tank any bill that they want to if they're, you know, coalesced. So it's going to be interesting to see how Republicans like getting rid of that rule and having Democrats, you know, come out squeaky clean on the other side, saying, yes, I do want to make sure that the U.S. Continues to function. There's also, on that same note, a supermajority to raise taxes, a supermajority vote to raise taxes. I guess this is something that posturing that the Republicans really don't want taxes to be raised. No one does. I don't think Democrats would vote for those taxes to be raised unless it were to be on, corporations, individuals with insane amounts of money that obviously don't need all that money, stuff like that, which they did when they passed the reconciliation bill in 2020, the Rescue Act in 2020 another reconciliation bill they passed in 2022 that did that. And the kicker for this is that McCarthy agreed to a plan that allows one vote to oust the speaker. So any member of Congress, I believe it's on the Republican side, I couldn't quite find any specificity on that, but one member, let's say, of the Republican Party could ask for a motion to vacate the chair. And that means for the speaker vote to be held again. And so they need one vote to vacate. And if they get the majority to vacate the seat, then they need to go through another process of electing a speaker again. That's funny that anyone in the Freedom Caucus at any time, when they're not happy with McCarthy, which they already aren't happy with McCarthy, many of them, especially people like Matt Gaetz, can call for a motion to vacate the chair. However, it does require a majority for you to get there. So I think that's it's a very difficult thing to do, but it does disrupt House business when you're gaveling in a session and there's consistently calls to motion to vacate the chair. And anyone can do it. Any one member can do it. I don't think Democrats would want to do it as much because it doesn't look good for them. Republicans don't really have any ramifications in that sense, any repercussions. But Democrats, sort of the McCarthy, you know, show is something that Democrats especially relish in. So, yeah, those are the new House rules, which I don't know how long many of them will stay. If I were to guess, I think proxy voting We'll come back sometime soon. So that's the House. In the Senate, there's not much going on. I think that there is a lot of judicial nominees that Biden will be putting up because that's sort of the only thing he's going to be able to get through. Got 51 seats, got one vote to spare. Realistically, two, because Harris, if it's 49-49, Harris can come in as a tiebreaker. So I expect to see a lot of judges, probably more so in a four-year term than Trump or you know, Obama. Obama did a lot, but, you know, in 8 years, he will probably do more than Biden will do in 4 years. And that takes us to 2024. In 2024, the House is a toss-up on who will take it back. The Senate, on the other hand, is likely to fall into Republican hands. You have a very good map for Republicans with states like West Virginia, Ohio, and Montana that are democratically held up for election. And you also have Democrats having to defend Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, Nevada. It's a super tough map. And unfortunately, I think there's going to be a little bit of a spending crunch, but there's going to be excess spending in races that don't really matter. And one of those races happens to be California's open Senate race. Dianne Feinstein, who is extremely old, I think she's 88 or something of the like. She has, clear dementia. She's not able to fulfill her role as senator, has decided to step down. And many representatives have joined in the Senate race, and I think more will continue to. You have MSNBC darlings like Adam Schiff and Katie Porter. They're both from Southern California. Schiff obviously was, you know, the main impeachment manager for Trump in the first, you know, main impeachment trial. And Katie Porter was elected in 2018. She has become very popular using her whiteboard. She especially became popular during the 117th Congress, yeah, which was her first Congress. So she's a sophomore Democrat, or junior Democrat now, because she was just reelected in 2022. Both of them are very popular. And then Barbara Lee, who's from Northern California. She is a little bit older. She's 76, so handing the seat from one person to the other that's sort of up there in age is not great. And the reason why I'm not a fan of this open California race happening now, I think there was no other choice for Feinstein but to retire. However, I think the bigger problem that I have with this race is that there's going to be a lot of Democrats that are going to jump in, and it's going to be a heavy spending primary. You're going to have a lot of money funneled to Adam Schiff and Katie Porter and all these members of Congress, and not even, you know, lower members that are going to be running for this race. It's going to be vicious. And in addition, the amount of money that's going to be spent is going to take away from the races that really need it, like Bob Casey in Pennsylvania, like John Tester in Montana, like Sherrod Brown in Ohio. These are races that, in the general, you're going to need that money, and instead it's going to be burnt in the California Senate open, you know, primary. And in addition, California also has a jungle primary rule. So what that means is the top, everyone, Republicans, Democrats, not affiliated, are all on one ballot. And the top two vote-getters are the ones that will proceed to the general election. So it is possible that Republicans get their stuff together, and they have two really well-qualified Republican candidates, people like Mike Garcia, like Michelle Steele, representatives there that won very well in 2022. Two of them go on the ballot, and there's so many Democrats that they split the vote. And two Republicans win, and Democrats get locked out. Because two Republicans, in theory, could both get around 20% of the vote. And if everyone else below that gets, you know, 19, 18%, something like that, then there will be no Democrat on the general ballot in 2024. So it would be two Republicans running against each other, which is an automatic Republican pickup. And that would be just devastating to Democrats' chances of taking back the Senate in any realm, in any election year. Democrats, you can't lose a seat in California, and I don't think they will, but it is a very interesting possibility that could happen. because of how California's election laws work. So it's a little unfortunate that's going to happen. That, you know, open race with all that money spent is going to sort of happen at a time Democrats will be not strapped for cash, but they'll need a lot of it. More Senate updates in West Virginia. Jim Justice has said he's probably running for U.S. Senate. Jim Justice is the sitting governor. He was elected as a Democrat in 2016 to West Virginia, and he promptly changed parties in 2017, understanding that a Democrat couldn't win in West Virginia anymore. So, he's the sitting governor. He'll be governor until 2024. And if he runs for that seat, I'd be perfectly happy. Him as a Republican in West Virginia, he's pro a lot of very liberal things, you know, social services, common sense gun laws. I think he'd be a great Republican to have in the U.S. Senate for West Virginia because I don't think Manchin's going to win re-election. In 2018, he won by 3%. And 3% is not enough in a Democratic plus 8 year in a Trump plus 40 state. So Jim Justice would be a great senator from that state. It'd be the replacement value would be decent with Manchin. And although he would give the Republicans the majority, I still think that it would be the right decision for him to. Or I hope that he would win the nomination. And then in Arizona, you have Kyrsten Sinema, who of course changed from Democratic to Independent, caucusing with the Democrats because Lord knows what goes on in that woman's head. And so she has said, has yet to say whether she'll run. She would run as an Independent. And the Democrat that just jumped into the race, who is the front runner, who will win probably without any competition, is Ruben Gallego, who's a representative of the Phoenix area. And he's a consistent Democratic overperformer. He's not from a swing district, but he always gets more than what is expected of his vote share. He's much more progressive, much more sort of truly liberal compared to Kyrsten Sinema. The problem is that if Gallego and Sinema both run, then the Republicans are likely to take that seat. And a Republican that just floated her name for the Senate is Carrie Lake. Carrie Lake is the failed Republican gubernatorial nominee in Arizona. She lost by about 0.7% to Katie Hobbs. She's a notorious election denier, far-right individual. Even being as Democratic as recently as 2016, so who knows what she actually believes. But she is strongly considering running for that Senate race, and I think that a Republican and a Democrat and Kyrsten Sinema is a recipe for failure for the Democrats. Apparently, people are not super concerned that Sinema is going to run again. I think it would be a really bad situation if she were to, because the DSCC, the Democratic campaign arm, is effectively required to support incumbents. And not funding a Democrat, whether it be Gallego or Sinema, is extremely bad for Democrats' chances, and Republicans would be, I would give them a likely situation to win the seat. Apparently, people think that Sinema is going to take a job in the private sector at some lobbying firm, and that would be very lucrative. So, they're of the mind that she won't run for re-election. This is her first term. She won in 2018, and many, many Democrats pulled for her. So I'd be upset if she were to run for re-election. I think she has sort of turned her back on many of the causes that she feels she campaigned on. And I guess the biggest one is that, you know, I think it's just such a funny story that she was outside the 2004 DNC and, you know, protesting for against Joe Lieberman, or she was complaining about Joe Lieberman. She was a Green Party activist in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, and she said about Joe Lieberman notoriously was a Democrat from Connecticut who switched parties and ran for the Connecticut for Lieberman Party. And Sinema asked, you know, is he even a Democrat? This was a notorious interview by the New York Times, very quick, brief statement by her, and I guess the same could say, are you even a Democrat, Kyrsten Sinema? So, though she caucuses with the Democrats, she votes with the Democrats. I don't know. I don't think she knows. So, that's a little bit of an unfortunate situation for Democrats, especially if they can only lose one seat. Losing one seat is at 50 seats for the Democrats, and that also requires them to hold the presidency. Speaking of the presidency, the most important political question is going to be DeSantis or Trump over the next year and change, year and a half. DeSantis has proven himself not necessarily to be an electoral juggernaut. I think that he happened to find a state that was really good for him at the time. 2018, he won by a tiny margin against a weak Democratic candidate for governor. In 2022, he won by 20 points. But Florida has lurched right. I mean, this was a competitive state. You had a Democratic senator from there. Obama won it twice. But even the incumbent Democratic senator in a blue wave lost in 2018. So if anyone's concerned about Florida being a swing state or investing money in there again, many people know that Biden will not be going there. He will not be spending time there. He will not be wasting precious campaigning time, because it is likely that he is the nominee. But the neighbor next door in Georgia, that's going to be the one to hit. And I think that DeSantis versus Trump, you have fascism with a pretty face or fascism with an ugly face. A palatable fascism or not so palatable. And if I were Biden, if I were any Democrat, because Biden's likely to run, I would prefer Trump on the ballot. Because Trump means Biden can win. And that helps every race for Democrats down ballot. I think that there is a lot of discussion about DeSantis being strong, and I think that that's true. I think DeSantis is the heir apparent to Trump's political dynasty, but Trump hates DeSantis because DeSantis takes away from his limelight, and Trump has a lot of hidden support that we've seen and we know all too well. He has been counted out in 2016 in the primaries. He was counted out in the 2016 general. He was counted out in the 2020 general, even more so than I think 2016. There is a hidden support for Trump that I think very few candidates have. There, not even DeSantis has that. Yes, the polling wasn't really quite on for DeSantis. I mean, it was never on for Trump. But everyone knew that that wasn't going to be a close race. Everyone. And DeSantis is a national figure now. He's the love for Republicans. I mean, even Shelley Moore Capito, who is a senator from West Virginia, said, the future of the party is with DeSantis. Unfortunately, that won't materialize. Because you have Facebook that's allowing Trump back onto their platform. Trump's running in 2024. You have a world in which Trump is going to seem as though he never caused an insurrection. And we're going to be faced again with that question of whether or not it is, appropriate for him to have done those things. And whether or not that is still in the mind of Democrats, like it was in 2022. Democrats capitalized on that, the fact that there were a lot of election denier insurrectionists running for major offices across the nation, and a lot of them won. Even though the big ones lost, a lot of them at the local levels won. But at the national level, are we ready for that? And obviously, we elected Trump once, kicked him out, which is very difficult to do with an incumbent, even if it was a closer election than many had hoped. But there is this pool of support for Trump that is there, and It's here to stay. And I think that DeSantis doesn't have that. He just doesn't. There's something about an appeal of Trump that DeSantis doesn't have. And in a split race, where you have people like DeSantis, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott. You have other hopefuls for the presidency. You're going to find that DeSantis will not have that same amount of support, and Trump will maintain his high degree of people who are hyper-motivated and hyper-partisan, because that's the people that he appeals to, but that's also who the people are in Republican primaries. They are the most conservative of all the Republicans. They're the ones that follow politics the most, and they're the ones that are the most motivated, and those are Trumpers. So, I think that the Trump-DeSantis fight, if it happens, I'm still not inclined to believe that DeSantis would throw his political career on the line for that, to lose to Trump. If it happens, if it were to happen, I think Democrats would be licking their chops. I think that if DeSantis wins the primary too, I don't think Trump's going anywhere. I think he's running third person, third party ticket. So the Trump-DeSantis battle that is brewing, whether or not it materializes, is great for Democrats. And on the Biden front, I mean, personally, I don't like the idea of Biden running again. Excuse me for one moment. Sorry about that. Where was I? Talking about the Biden Democratic primary. I think that there is something to be said for the possibility of the likelihood of Biden running for re-election. I think that's what everyone assumes. I think that he's a really, really bad fit. Not because he's, the most progressive Democrat, or because of anything that he's done wrong per se. I just think back to 2008 and 2012 when Democrats had overwhelming victories, and the reason why was because Obama was young and Obama was new and fresh, and that young people got behind him, especially in 2008. And I think you're going to see a lot of difficulty with Biden campaigning. Campaigning's super difficult. I mean, imagine your grandfather running around the country making speeches, obviously not messing up, not saying anything wrong, like doing these things that a presidential candidate has to do, and they have to be sort of young to do that. And I don't think Biden has the stamina for it. He barely had it in 2020. Another two plus years? Or no, a little bit less than 2 years. But personally, I would, appreciate it if he stepped aside. But it's also really, really bad for him to step aside, because incumbents tend to win. People are very happy with incumbents, especially if the economy is doing well. I think that Biden will run, and I think that his heir should be Gretchen Whitmer or Raphael Warnock. And I love the ticket of Whitmer-Warnock. I think that those are the two biggest, in my mind, Democratic successors to Biden's sort of administration. I think they have electoral support, and they've proven. I think they're smart and they're young, and I think I think the Democratic Party would be remiss to not have them as national figures. And they have become national figures, but national in the political sense as well, in the governing sense. I think that it's a shame because Whitmer is only there until 2026. And I really, really do like her. But I think that Biden has the appeal only when Trump is there. And if it's Biden versus DeSantis, it's going to be much closer. And I'd give the edge to DeSantis. Because DeSantis gets Republicans motivated in a way that I think he would be able to replicate Trump doing. I think the harder thing for him is going to be the primary if he does run. So there's a lot to kind of consider there. And I think that Biden is in a very strong place. And I think if things turn for him in a way where he sees himself not being able to sort of keep up or the Democrats not doing as well, he won't run again. But at this point, he's running again, but everything else is kind of quiet. He's sort of riding the wave, the good news wave. He is enjoying he's enjoying the good economy. Obamacare signups are up, border crossings are down. There's a lot that's going right for him that I think there's not much more that can go right in the next 2 years. Will be status quo because Republicans control the House, so a lot of it's going to be executive action. But Biden, if I was Biden right now, I'd be pretty happy. I'd be sitting pretty. Get those judges through. Make sure that Democrats can continue to shape the courts, and just wait for the next insane Supreme Court ruling and deal with that. But I think that's all for now. This was Swing Politics with Mitch Saunders, Big Mitch. Hope you enjoyed. And I'll be here every other week, 7 to 8. So, please tune in. And I'll be sure to go over some more pertinent political news next. Maybe not relating to elections so much, but I've got a good one in the Wisconsin State Supreme Court race that is extremely crucial in a similar way like the Hector LaSalle nomination for the New York Court of Appeals. So I'll be sure to get into that next time. But for now, this has been Swing Politics. Thanks so much.
Just trying to turn on the where is it? Yeah, so if you look at it.